When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Joseph.
And I'm Nick.
And this is Fish Jelly.
Oh, yes.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. We're recording this a day late because you've been in New York.
Yes.
How was that?
Well, I love New York. It's...
Okay, Madonna.
You know, other cities make you feel like a dork. It's one of the few places... It's like, kind of like being in the eye of the storm. But it's also one of the... Well... What?
Go ahead. Describe New York City. Go ahead.
No, I
like
love
it's this magical, wondrous place.
Oh no, but it's one of the few places that it. Well, probably like this or Berlin, where I feel like this interesting mix of happy, sad. Where I don't know. It's a place that makes me feel like time passes and I haven't done half the things I want to do. And it's also a place that makes me feel inspired to keep trying to do them, if that makes sense. But I just really like, again, living there, I'm highly, highly romanticized in my mind, but I'm sure that it is a different beast living there than it is visiting. But you know, I got to be there in April to interview Parker Posey, and I hadn't been there in a decade, and it just really made me miss being there. I just like being there. I didn't even have plans for what I was gonna do at night, but every day there are just so many. There are an endless possibility of things you could do, and I saw an off-Broadway play with Sean Young. The Today's Secret film was because of something that was playing that I had the opportunity to see. It was very restful. And it was a very warm November there for right now. So it just, I was very happy to be there.
Good for you. What do you want to say about Sean Young?
Well, actually, I had wanted to see Aubrey Plaza made her Broadway. Well, no, it was off Broadway debut in John Patrick Shanley play. I'm forgetting something. Danny in the Deep Blue Sea. Danny and something. Starring her and Christopher Abbott, kind of a kitchen sink domestic hell drama. But it didn't get very good reviews. But by the time I thought about it, it was sold out. The Sean Young play Ode to the Wasp Woman was not, and. It's credited as a new noir play written and directed by somebody named Ryder McDowell. So I walked from the little hotel I was staying in to this off-Broadway production, and I get there and I realize this venue, the Actors Temple Theater, doubles as like a Jewish mortuary.
Oh.
Looked like funerals happening there. So it was very interesting. There were 12 people in the audience. Maybe one person younger than me, who I think was the brother or the boyfriend of one of the other ladies starring in the play. But I found the title misleading because it's actually four vignettes, each dealing with a Hollywood tragedy of sorts, including the actor that played the little boy Alfalfa, George Reeves, who is the original Superman and his dismal end, and Barbara Payton, who... You know, Barbara Payton wrote this book called I'm Not Ashamed that I have wanted to read for years. Sean Young is Susan Cabot, who, of course, played the Wasp Woman in the Roger Corman production, which is, if you like the Leech Woman, you'll like the Wasp Woman. Anyway, so she was kind of a B-movie queen, and that was hobbled by, she had a child that suffered from dwarfism, and that child ended up stabbing her to death.
Oh.
In the 80s. There was going to be a movie made about it starring Rose McGowan probably 20 years ago. something with ocean in the title. And I think that obviously never came to fruition, but Cabot's life is probably is just as interesting as her film career. So it leads Sean Young and this young man playing her son that is pretending to be a dwarf through an interview. Somebody's come to interview her and she totally blows it, kind of like Barbara Pleas in Mommy Dearest, because they have such an enmeshed and dysfunctional relationship out of necessity. And I found it, her segment I thought was rather touching. It's also a musical. Each vignette, the lead who was killed gets a little musical number. And I actually, probably because it's Sean Young and how I feel about her, felt kind of emotional watching that. And then at the end of the play, the other young man in the crowd who stood up for the woman playing Barbara Payton, who I'm assuming he knows personally, I was the only one that stood up for Sean Young, which I don't know. It just made me feel really bad. Cause
how does she look?
I thought she looked great. You know, she's my mom's age. I think, you know, what did we just watch that terrible movie, Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde. I think she's so striking and beautiful. She has a very, I think, interesting and familiar, like if I hear her voice, I know it's her speaking, her speech patterns. So I really appreciated that opportunity. And I'm sure, you know, there are probably a lot of productions, stage productions like this going on in the city because of the SAG actor strike, because people need to work. So I don't know, but I didn't love the play altogether. I think it was 2 hours and there's no intermission. And then I felt bad because the other 10 people there were quite a bit older and very decrepit. And like there was some old lady that kept yammering about, when is it going to end? Through some of these actors' monologues, it's like, woman, shut the fuck up.
What else would you like to say about New York?
My legs hurt because I probably walked in the evenings 6-7 miles because I stomped all over that city. I was in Soho, Tribeca, Chelsea, Hell's Kitchen, Brooklyn. And, you know, I was only there, 4 nights? And one of those nights I was laid up because I was not feeling well. But, I mean, it's just a very motivating place to be.
I forgot to mention, we're recording this today on your birthday.
Yes, we are.
How do you feel about your birthday?
I feel like that was the reason I took the trip to New York. And I think the eye in the center of the storm comment was in relation to that. Because I don't really look forward to my birthdays anymore. But there's that bittersweet quality about it, is just, you know, it's the inevitability of time and it is what it is. And, you just gotta roll with it. And, yeah, here we are.
Well, we'll move on. I wonder if people outside of LA know about the 10 freeway. Like, because here it's a big deal, right?
Here's a huge deal, but nobody,
For people who don't know, a section of the 10 freeway near downtown LA was closed because there was a fire. And this happened, I think, 2 weeks ago?
We were in Minnesota when it happened.
So immediately after the fire was put out, the mayor, Karen Bass, said that the freeway would be shut down, that section, indefinitely because of structural damage, and they just don't know.
Isn't indefinitely always kind of a scary word?
Yes. But then our mayor, Gavin Newsom, our governor, said, oh no, 2 to 3 weeks. And he said this like 3 days ago. And then on Sunday, yesterday, he says, oh, that thing will be open tonight. And sure enough, when I woke up this morning, it's open, both lanes.
Yep.
I think it reminded me of the COVID vaccine. Initially we were told, well, it takes years and years to develop a vaccine.
Oh, yeah. And they're like, nope.
And then 3 months later, like, oh, we got it. Like, are we sure that this overpass is structurally sound?
We are going to find out.
But then they had Kamala Harris up there talking about, like, I'm on it. I drove across it. It's good.
Yeah, right now. Okay.
Well, whatever. People don't care.
There was a major bridge that collapsed when I lived in Minneapolis.
Yeah, the 35W.
And I remember Patti Smith giving a performance saying, like, saying some weird comment, like, look out for your bridges.
But anyway, Let us all say a prayer to Tom Cruise, Oprah, Buddha, whoever you believe in, that that bridge, that overpass doesn't collapse.
Was the fire started by a homeless encampment?
So there is a person of interest. There are pictures all over of this man wearing like a blue outfit with shorts. You can't tell. I mean, it would just be, that could have been me. It wasn't, but it's really hard to distinguish. But there are pictures of this person who is suspected.
Like he started it.
And then it's a very interesting. So the building that burned apparently is a contractor for the state. And Gavin Newsom was talking about how they have they're in default with the state.
Oh,
and owe money. So I'm sure like a year from now we're going to hear some pretty interesting stuff about that fire and the building that burned. But yeah, I just wanted to bring it up because I think it's funny that we went from indefinitely to 2 to 3 weeks to tonight in the course of like a week.
Yeah, when I got on my flights back yesterday and saw that it would be opening, I'm like, oh, okay.
Speaking of sound structures, there's a barbershop in the border of West Hollywood, or on the border of West Hollywood, on La Brea and Fountain, called Trendsetters. We used to live in walking distance. And you've actually been there with me once when I got my hair cut there.
Yeah.
I've had my hair cut there maybe like 3 times.
As like a bald white man sitting there, they all kind of would periodically look at me like, what you doing here?
I hate that barbershop. I hate barbershops in general. They just feel so uncomfortable, like these misogynistic, homophobic places where the barbers typically don't even recognize who they're talking to. It's like, why are you asking me about my girlfriend or talking to me about some sports team of which I don't even know which sport it is? But every time I've been, I regret going. They're overpriced. The last time I went to get a haircut there, it was $60 plus a tip. So I gave him $72 for a haircut that should have been $30. And it wasn't even that good. But anyway, this barbershop has had so many problems because remember back in the day, Kat Von D, her reality show about her barbershop, mm-hmm. that tattoo parlor is next to Trendsetters.
Yeah, I remember that because the Ralph's we used to go to is there.
Yep. And remember when Kat Von D's place caught on fire?
Yep.
So then that shut down Trendsetters.
Yep.
And then over the weekend, there's video of it. A truck ran into Trendsetters, like through the window. So now it's shut down because of that.
Wow.
So, you know, there's that gas station across the street. Do you know what I'm talking about? The one on Fountain, mm-hmm. which I've never been to all these years.
I had to out of necessity when we lived over there.
Because it's priced higher than the gas station that was closer to our apartment. But anyway, this big ass, like quad cab dually, like it looks like it's an F-350 pickup truck, was at the gas station and the driver didn't put it in park. They put it in neutral. So the truck rolled out. It's this big red pickup truck rolled across Fountain and ran right into the side of this barbershop. So the photos of it, you can see like a third of the pickup truck is inside the barbershop. And it's scary because the truck hits a big vending machine and the vending machine topples and I swear comes like 1 centimeter away from landing on a customer. But I wanted to read what one of the barbers said about that. He says, this guy, he literally turned the chair right as the vending machine was coming down, almost took his legs out, but the barber flipped his chair because that's what we do here at Trendsetters. We take care of our clients.
Girl, please.
But
saving them from disaster.
You need to watch the video because it's pretty dramatic. Like this truck hits it hard. And then you see this vending machine fly and almost hit this man. So thankfully that person didn't get hurt, but now they're closed down for another few weeks to repair. But I didn't realize this is the 6th time a car has ran into that barbershop, like through the window.
Wow.
This barbershop is raggedy and cursed, but I wanted to tell that. Anyway, moving on. You sent me, I think it was you. So on the Alien Quadrilogy box set.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ridley Scott made this comment about the movie.
But you know who sent me that? Your friend Ryan.
Kaiser?
Yeah. Oh. Oh.
Damn. Well, I might have to bleep that. I don't know. Damn. The comment says, she refused to pull up her panties. So talking about Sigourney Weaver in that infamous scene where she, in Alien.
The first one,
mm-hmm. where she's just in her little like top and panties.
Her floss, yeah.
Ridley Scott says, she refused to pull up her panties and shave at all. We had to pay someone in 1979 something like $5,000 to airbrush out all of her minge hair on every single cell of film. It took weeks.
And my response was, good for her.
But you know, it's so funny because whenever I see that scene, I always think, God, it looks like her vagina is the size of a peephole because her panties are so small, mm-hmm. and they're so low.
And she had no butt.
And she has no ass.
She's a skinny white lady.
And then you don't see anything. Like you don't. So then now it makes sense that someone had to go through and airbrush all that shit out.
If you think about it, they were sleeping for how long when they wake up at the beginning of Alien? There would be rampant pubic hair.
But I was so confused because I didn't watch this movie until I was an adult. And I had never seen a vagina at that point. I'm like, how? Like, are they really just like little like peepholes? Like, what? How is her little spot so?
Well, she's also very thin there, and she was 28, I think. But yes, and I know that for a generation of young men that kind of awakened their hetero men awakened their sexuality, because you know, when I in junior high, everybody thought that I was obsessed with Sigourney Weaver because they thought I wanted to have sex with her, and it's like no.
I just like her.
I just worship her.
Moving on. So a lot of films get accused of gay baiting and like actors and directors and productions.
Yeah,
and
James Franco used to be at the forefront of that.
And oftentimes I think like, I don't know if I agree with what people are saying. Like, so like just because someone's okay with something being gay or just because they, no, I don't always. However, there is a recent film that no one is saying this about that I do think is gay baiting. And it's a movie we reviewed called Saltburn. Because I keep seeing all these headlines like this gay thriller. It's not a gay movie.
It's not. No. And in fact, I don't think the lead character has really reconciled what he actually does feel.
I don't think the main character's sexuality is even like fully established. And Barry Keoghan is the main character. He does have sex with a man and a woman in the movie, but it's more like he uses it as like manipulation. Mm-hmm. He does seem infatuated with this other guy. What's his name? Eldrin?
James Elordi? Jacob Elordi?
Jacob Elordi. But they're never sexual. They're never like they don't do anything together. And Jacob Elordi's character seems like he's not gay. He's in a relationship with, he has a girlfriend in the beginning. We see him trying to hook up with a woman towards the end. So I think the fact that people keep saying that feels felonious, but what makes me think it's gay baiting is I've been seeing Barry Keoghan and Jacob Elordi doing all these, like all this press for the movie. Uh-huh. And they're being really affectionate to one another. And like Barry Keoghan's making comments alluding to like him being nude and very like, you know, cheeky, wink, wink, nudge, nudge type stuff. And it kind of feels gross to me. Like, the team knows that it's appealing to maybe like gay audiences and everyone thinks Jacob Elordi is attractive maybe. So then they're playing it up like they're a cute little couple, but that's not the movie.
No,
they are not a couple in the movie. No. They don't even end up liking each other. Spoiler alert, Barry Keoghan kills Jacob Elordi in the end. Cause Jacob Elordi is like, I don't even want to fuck with you. Like, you're creepy to me.
He's so like, you make my blood run cold. This is not like, quite unlike the press of I Love You, Philip Morris. Remember with Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor, where they had like, they were blatantly sexual and at the red carpet, they kissed each other like affectionately. And George Stephanopoulos, I remember, asked Ewan McGregor, like made some comment and Ewan McGregor got pissy with him. Like, well, why wouldn't we?
You know, I'm not as familiar with that scenario. Just hearing you talk about it, it doesn't bother me. But for some reason, because in the movie, they are affectionate. So then to me, it like translates to in real life, like, oh, isn't that fun to see these actors like they really committed to the role? But for Barry Keoghan, I don't know. Watching several press things they did, it made me feel like, oh, they're playing it up.
They definitely are playing it
up. And that's not what this movie is. So I don't like that.
Well, plus I think that the film is somewhat of a mixed bag and is, you know, very, very familiar to Patricia Highsmith. So, you know.
Moving on to the restaurant section, I wanted to complain about overpriced street tacos.
I don't like street tacos anyway. They're too small.
Well, you can't. I mean, you. It's not that you don't like. They're like they're tasty.
They're tasty,
but they're too small
and too expensive. Like
and too expensive. Why am I paying $8, $9, sometimes $13 for a little bitty taco? So then it's like now I just paid $26 because that's happened. $26 for two little tacos.
It's just like it's like,
and then no beans, no rice, no, like. I guess as far as portion control goes, it's great. But then it's like, so I just paid $26 to barely be satiated.
It's just street tacos. Anytime that gourmet Mexican street food or any kind of ethnic street food is kind of marketed in that way, I think it's like white people trying to be cute. I don't know.
But I'm bringing it up because there's a Guisado's.
I can't stand Guisado's.
Next to my mom's place, which I didn't realize. I didn't realize because one... on Thursday or one day when you were gone, I went to go see my mom and one street up from her, it's like an entirely different world. I never realized. So I went to go pick us up lunch.
Yes, Ariel.
And I'm like, let me just order Guisado's. And they had a sampler platter of street tacos.
We've had that. We had that at the one in West Hollywood.
I didn't remember that. Cause if I had, I wouldn't have ordered it. It was $11 for six tacos. And I thought, well, as small as their little tacos are, I guess that's a good deal. Chill. The tortillas for the tacos, you know how you buy like the tortilla chips in the bag that are round, like the round Tostitos?
Yeah.
Those tortillas weren't even that big.
Yeah.
And then they had a little bitty like tablespoon of stuff on them. And then a little piece, like some of them had like a little piece of like avocado on them, the size of like a candy corn.
Yep.
$11. For six.
You can save it. I'll eat a banana. I don't need that.
You know my mom eats like a bird.
Well, perfect for her then.
And even she was like, oh, this is
we ordered doll food.
It was good enough for her, and that's bad. For my mom to be like, oh, this is a decent amount of a plate is really bad because my mom eats like a damn bird.
And it's so bizarre because if she fixes you a plate, it's like, I'm not a Jolly Green Giant lady.
If my mom fixes you a plate, prepare to get stuffed.
Your mom one time was like,
do you want some cake?
Do you want some cake? And I'm like, sure, I'll have a little cake.
She cuts off a slice from the cake.
No, she didn't. She handed me she gave me the platter of the cake, which with 3/4 of the cake was
no, like, she did. Fork. Right. But she had cut off a little slice of cake first.
Yes.
To put on a plate, and then the rest of the cake she gave to you.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't. She just gave me a fork and the cake on a platter. I'm like, I'm not. What are you trying to do to me?
Wow.
But that's her love language, I think.
But anyway, yeah, I'm so tired of these overpriced street tacos. Like, no one wants that.
See, your memory, you already knew.
Well, I mean, I should have known. I will say though, they sell tamales, and I didn't know they do. They were tasty. There was way too much masa in the tamale, but I was surprised because they were only like $4 each. So I was expecting them to be the size of like a Snickers bar, but they were actually pretty big and pretty tasty. Moving on to films released. Oh, wait.
I had something in a sorry to this man section.
I also have something in the sorry to this man section. Go ahead.
Mine was, it came to my attention that I misspoke when we were talking about the driver's seat with Liz Taylor last week, because I was trying to draw that Muriel Spark connection and Maggie Smith winning the Oscar for Private Miss Jean Brody. When Maggie Smith won, Hollywood was punishing Jane Fonda, which I very well know, who was up for They Shoot Horses, Don't They? My favorite with her. And Liz Taylor, they gave that for Suddenly Last Summer because, you know, she was fucking around with Eddie Fisher, Debbie Reynolds, you know, Carrie's dad.
Yeah.
They punished her by giving it to Simone Signoret. And then, of course, the next year won for Butterfield 8, which is not really anybody considers a good film. But anyway, to set the record straight, I know better. I was just talking.
Well, I had said in our Thanksgiving movie review, like the horror film Thanksgiving, that I don't want to say who the killer is because that just seems reckless. But I had said that the killer is just killing these people at random. But it's not random.
It's not random.
Like, every person that he sought, the killer sought, they had some involvement in the riot. So I shouldn't have said it was random. What I was trying to say is that the surge that happens that causes the death that makes the killer want to get revenge is the result of this huge mob. So to me, it would have made sense for him to attack the mob, which is what then I said would have been the better story of like locking the mob inside the store and plucking them off one by one. But I misspoke in saying that the people he did choose were random. It's not random.
But the story feels very random and scattershot because at the end of the day, what was he trying to achieve with killing these specific people?
I don't want to make it seem like, I mean, calling him, his selections random, that's not accurate.
Of course.
I just think that it would have made more sense to try to kill more people then, but whatever.
Well, right. It's silly. Silly.
Can we get through the films we can. We have 4 minutes.
Okay.
Films released we didn't cover. Next Goal Wins.
You didn't even respond to me on this one, which is fine. I actually saw this in late 2022, but it's finally coming out. Taika Waititi. I think a woefully miscast Michael Fassbender. There is nothing friendly or sweet about Michael Fassbender's screen presence.
I do like him, but I agree.
He's much more suited for something like The Killer. But not even that, because in Fincher's The Killer, there's this whole bit in his monologue about how you have to not be distinct and blended to the crowd. And that man does not blend into any crowd. But whatever. I didn't like Next Goal Wins. I thought it was corny and silly.
Trolls Band Together.
There's no way I was watching this. And I didn't even ask you if you wanted to.
Is that a cartoon?
Yeah, the Trolls movies. Directed by Walt Dorn.
Dashing Through the Snow.
Tim Story directed a Christmas movie starring Lil Rel and Ludacris and a whole bunch of other people.
Disney Plus. Might make a good secret movie.
Probably, but we just didn't have time.
The Disappearance of Sherry Height.
Cher Height. I think, directed by Nicole Newnham with, I think it's a documentary with narration by Dakota Johnson about this woman who wrote this, I forget, it's a very notable book on sexuality, I might be misspeaking, who suddenly dropped out of sight. But it sounded interesting enough to see, but because I'm very ignorant about the subject.
Fallen Leaves.
If I was doing a top 20 this year, it would be my top 20. But I saw this at Cannes. It won the jury prize. A new film by Aki Kaurismäki. Wonderful film. I highly enjoyed it. And it's short. If you like him at all, I think this is him kind of doing all the hits sort of thing. And Joseph, I think you'd really like it as well. It's very sweet.
Lastly, Please Don't Destroy the Treasure of Foggy Mountain.
Some kids movie on Peacock directed by Paul Berganti. I didn't even ask you about it either.
Okay, well, let's take...
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Movies watched for fun. Something called Vera?
Vera, yeah. I did an interview with the directors, Tiza Kovi and Rainer Frimmel, and the lead star, Vera Gemma, who's the daughter of Giuliani Gemma, the noted spaghetti Western actor. And it's kind of an odd hybrid fiction, like documentary fiction film where she's playing herself, but what happens is really kind of fictionalized, even though it has basis in her real life. It won Best Director and Actress out of the Horizon Sidebar in Venice, but it is Austria's official submission for Best International Feature. So I did a recorded interview, which might post today on Ion Cinema. And I was just tapped to interview them in person for a Q&A as well. But I thought it was really fascinating. I was ignorant of who she was beforehand, even though she's had bit parts in several Dario Argento films. She's good friends with Ozzie Argento. I thought it was really fascinating and kind of moving. And what I'd imagine is a very cathartic experience for this person, who is this woman who is never considered as beautiful as her father and has heavily modified herself, which, you know, has further kind of hobbled her chances at success. But Yeah, I think it really addresses nepotism in an interesting way, and kind of how being the child of very famous artists is also very limiting. There's another, just as we might think that it opens all these doors, it also limits one as well.
Next, Never Fear.
This was an Ida Lupino film that she directed that I'd never seen. It's interesting. It's about this couple who are trying to make it big as dancers, this man and this woman, and then she comes down with polio. And of course, you know, that's debilitating before vaccinations. And then decides that she can no longer marry this man she's engaged to because she's going to be useless to him in the rehabilitation process, because it's never quite certain if, you know, you can learn to walk again, but maybe not. So it feels very much of the time. And it's, I believe Lupino herself had polio, and this is semi-autobiographical. But the lead star, Sally Forrest, reminded me quite a bit of somebody like a Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Next, you watched The Strangler.
This was very interesting. It's a restoration release of this 1970 title. I think that came out, that was released probably only in New York on Friday, by Paul Vecchiali, a very notable queer art house director. I've only ever seen one other Vecchiali film, and that was in 2016. He had a film at Cannes starring Deneuve called Le Cancer. I'd have to double check that title, but that's what I remember it as. But this is about this young man that goes around killing all these lonely women that kind of want to be killed anyway, kind of similar to the Liz Taylor Driver's Seat storyline. And then ends up having a correspondence with this policeman posing as a journalist on TV, trying to track him down. But I thought it was very fascinating and very dark and disturbing.
Something called The Pigeon Tunnel.
Errol Morris has a new documentary about John le Carré, the author who wrote things like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, The Little Drummer Girl, et cetera, et cetera. And The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, which was made into a very famous film with Richard Burton, which I've never seen, actually. But he was really a spy. He was really a double agent. And so it's fascinating listening to him as an old man. He died in 2020. Talk about his experiences. I think the score of the film is really leading it into a more menacing territory. But it's interesting listening to this man, and we learn a lot about his relationship with his parents that kind of crafted his journey. And then, of course, turning from a spy into a world famous author. It's worth a look.
The Unknown Country.
You know, I had missed this release from Music Box Films. It's Lily Gladstone's other release, who you just saw in Killers of the Flower Moon. And she's the lead in this kind of road trip journey movie about a woman who's from Minnesota, a Native American woman, and she's going on this mysterious journey. And it's directed by Marissa Maltz, and it takes kind of all these little side moments to kind of explain the character she's meeting on the way. And to me, those were my favorite parts, some of which are very moving, but always reminding us that you really never know what somebody's going through. And if you did, you might discover a lot of really interesting, wonderful people in your everyday life. But I liked the vibe of the film. I didn't love it.
Lastly, Lady Caliph.
Is that pronounced Caliph? Caliph?
Caliph? Caliph? I don't know. You watched it. They don't say the name?
No, because that's...
I don't know.
I want to shout out a website that I've actually used before, but I didn't realize that it's got such a huge library of rare... It's called rarefilm2ms.com. There is such a huge library of old, lost, forgotten, obscure films starring, if you like film, all kinds of people you love. But I had been looking for Romy Schneider films that I hadn't seen, and I'd never heard of this, and I watched it, and it's not very good. But and she's kind of miscast as the... wife of a factory worker in 1970 Italy, who's badly dubbed, but because she's just too beautiful. Like, she's just too beautiful to be believable in this role. No, Romy Schneider's stunning. And I can't, yeah, she just doesn't work in this role. But it's the directorial debut of Alberto Bevilacqua, who directed several other and wrote several other films, but this is adapted from his own book starring Ugo Tognazzi. And it, apparently in Schneider's diary, she said that he didn't know what he was doing at this point as a filmmaker. And it kind of comes across, it feels very familiar. Her husband is killed. There are all these worker strikes going on in Italy. And then she has this, she blames the owner of this factory, Tognazzi, and then ends up being his lover. It was something to sit through. But if you like Romy Schneider, who's always beautiful to look at, there you go.
All right, moving on to our secret film. This week it was your choice, mm-hmm. inspired by me.
Yes.
So the film you chose is the 1986 British period drama film, The Mission, mm-hmm. directed by Roland Joffé.
Yes.
Okay, so the reason you chose this film is because there was a theater nearby.
The Roxy.
Where you were in New York, so you had access to it. But it caught your attention because... during like a couple of years ago, there was a tribute concert to the composer of this film,
Morricone,
Ennio Morricone, mm-hmm. At the O2 Arena in London. And it was led by Morricone's son, Andre. And I noticed that Janet Jackson was in attendance. Mm-hmm. And then she started posting like these stories of her at the concert, her with Andrea Morricone, Ennio's son. And then she even like, you know, because she rarely gets on video talking, but she actually like got on video and was saying like how much she loved it, how Ennio Morricone is her favorite composer, and that her favorite piece of work of his, which also happens to be Ennio's favorite piece of his own work,
yeah,
is for the movie The Mission. So that's how this movie got on my radar, is that it's Janet Jackson's favorite like score. So we watched it. The premise of this film, 18th century Spanish Jesuits try to protect a remote South American tribe in danger of falling under the rule of pro-slavery Portugal.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in this movie. It's only 2 hours. It feels like it needs to be like a series. Like telling the story is going to be complicated because I feel like it's four different movies, but I guess the lead is Robert De Niro.
I think De Niro and Jeremy Irons are pretty, because the film kind of oscillates between them.
Really. It does. So Robert De Niro plays a character named Rodrigo Mendoza. Uh-huh. And Jeremy Irons plays Father Gabriel. So Jeremy Irons is this Jesuit, like monk guy. Mm-hmm. And Robert De Niro is, I think, supposed to be a Spanish mercenary. Uh-huh. And he's out in Paraguay, like in the jungles, basically like hunting. They're called the Guarani. G-U-A-R-A-N-I. He's like hunting them and then like trapping them and selling them as slaves.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then of course, Jeremy Irons, along with Liam Neeson, who's also like a Jesuit monk, they're out there trying to convert these people to Christianity. So both of them are enslaving these people, but
I think the title of this movie could be Good Colonizer, Bad Colonizer, but
for sure. But okay. So a lot's happening. Robert De Niro, his brother, who's played by Aidan Quinn,
yep.
who's Irish,
yeah,
he is cheating. Robert De Niro's girlfriend is cheating on him with his brother, Aidan Quinn. So Robert De Niro gets mad and kills Aidan Quinn.
But there's a conversation. She tells him, like, look, I love your brother more. I want to be with him. Kick rocks. And she's like, you won't hurt him, will you? And then the very next scene is...
he shoots and kills him.
No, he stabs him.
Oh, that's right. He stabs him. But then Robert De Niro gets in contact with Jeremy Irons and the Jesuits, and they say that, you know, he can find forgiveness through paying penance. And basically his penance is like he has to climb up this hill. What's that one mythological story about the rock?
Prometheus.
Is that
Sisyphus.
Sisyphus.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. Like he has to carry this big ass, like a suit of armor and like a net. He just has to drag it up and down this hill.
Well, they're bringing him to the mission at the top of the, was it the Guazu Falls?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
But the Jesuits at a point are like, we feel like he's paid his penance.
Liam Neeson.
Because, well, he, Liam Neeson says, myself and the other dudes think that like De Niro has done enough.
The bros think he's good.
Yeah, the bros think he's good. And Jeremy Irons is like, well, but he doesn't. And that's all that matters. Like, that's what penance is. Like, right. Until he feels good about it, he needs to keep going. But at a point, the Guarani tribe people, they end up like forgiving him. Mm-hmm. Even though he was capturing them and selling them to slavery. I think a weak part of the story is how quickly, I don't think these indigenous people took to Christianity as easily as this film makes it seem.
I agree.
Like, I'm sure they fought against that shit and then just finally had to give up. But
this isn't a story about that.
It's a story about control. Control. Yes. They forgive De Niro and they cut the armor off of him, basically freeing him from the binds that tie, right? So then there's, I posted it on our Fish Jelly Instagram.
Yes, where he cries and then laughs.
Oh yeah. My God. I just think De Niro is so wrong for this role. And every time he's on screen, it makes me giggle.
But I also thought he was quite fetching with that hair. And maybe,
I think he's handsome, yes.
Maybe it's because I never had an opportunity.
I thought Jeremy Irons was handsome.
They're both very handsome.
And so is Liam Neeson. But anyway, so now that De Niro feels freed, loose woman thou art freed, he decides to become a Jesuit. Okay, but then in the background, and I'm not a history person, but Spain occupies this region of Paraguay, but they're considering like signing it over to Portugal. But the problem, so Spain is like, well, we don't really believe in slavery, but
except they do,
except we do, like, we just turned a blind eye to it. But Portugal, they absolutely believe in slavery. So if they sign this region over to Portugal, these people will certainly become slaves. So,
but
there's a dilemma.
Both countries adhere to the dictates the church. Of the church. Yes.
But so there's a dilemma because basically in this region, they will either, they either have to like give up one of the missions and like displace the indigenous people or maintain the mission and the Jesuits there. But then these people will become slaves. So ultimately, Jeremy Irons is a little bit of a bitch about it because he's like, well, as priests, our job is to like adhere to the church and like we just have to believe that everything will be fine. And De Niro's like, nah, we need to fight back. Uh-huh. So he decides to fight back. And immediately we get a little like sequence where he's like training because he used to be a fighter. So yes. Then he like trains with his little sword, which made me giggle. He looked crazy. He looked like those crabs, how crabs walk. Uh-huh. But immediately when De Niro goes out there to fight, he gets shot and killed.
No, he doesn't.
It's like not that, like it's like.
They take care of quite a few of them. They ambush them, yeah.
What I recalled, it seemed like immediately he was killed.
No.
But anyway, and he convinces Liam Neeson to join him. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Irons takes a different approach. He gets all of the indigenous people together and...
mostly women and children.
And he puts on his little Pope dress and he walks. He has like a peaceful march towards the soldiers.
While they're singing, because he's taught them all to sing.
And those people don't care. We see them shoot kids. Like,
oh, yeah. They just decimate them, yeah.
And the end is that these people are decimated. Some of them do like run off into the jungle. And then the final scene of the film is we see some of the children come back to the area to try to salvage some of their belongings. The end. And then there's like a final line. Well, first it says like the Jesuits continue to try to protect the indigenous people to this day. And then we get a line from, it's some Bible verse that says the light shineth in the darkness and the darkness hath not overcome it. Uh-huh. Which I think is a pretty powerful line, actually. Yeah. But you really liked this movie. I was not feeling it at all.
And I don't know if it's because I got to see it in the confines of a theater. Perhaps.
And I was sitting in my house with my cat bothering me. I don't know.
I don't think it's perfect. When it started, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a long film for me. But at the end, I was quite emotional.
So this movie was nominated for 7 Academy Awards. It won for Best Cinematography.
Chris Menges, who also, this was his second Academy, and his first was for Roland Joffe's The Killing Fields from 1984. So this is the Roland Joffe at the height of his directorial career.
And then, regarding the cinematography, there are only two moments that I thought were striking. The opening where we see, because the Guarani people, there was another Jesuit trying to spread the word of God and they weren't trying to hear it. So they tie him to a cross and throw him over a waterfall. That looks really good.
It looks excellent.
And then in the end, when we see Jeremy Irons walking with the indigenous people and getting shot, I thought that was beautifully shot. But the other 2 hours felt kind of like a well-shot movie, as good as any other movie.
I think it reminded me of kind of like early Herzog. I really liked how it looked.
It looks fine, but I mean, there have been other films we've seen where I'm like, wow,
and
this is breathtaking.
You also didn't mention that it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes that year.
Okay, and then I was trying to pay attention to the score because my girl said it's her favorite score. And I have to be honest, like that score would have totally washed over me if I weren't actively trying to like notice it.
But
I still couldn't tell you, like it didn't leave an impression on me at
maybe
all.
Maybe you should listen to it on its own. But to me, I think that really is the purpose of a score, is it shouldn't really override the film.
You're not wrong.
I did notice the score, and I think it's really kind of moody and dark and mysterious, and it's not my favorite Morricone score. That would probably be Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion, but or Hateful Eight, for which he finally won an Oscar for. But I could still sense its presence, and I think it does add a different layer to it, as a lot of his scores do.
The main thing I didn't care for was the casting. I think, like, I almost feel like how I felt about Napoleon. Like, it's doing too much. These people don't really match who I think they're supposed to be representing, so it's a little confusing. As much as, like, as handsome as Robert De Niro is, like, I just found him so distracting. And his acting, like, but just made me giggle more than anything.
But both the leads are able to imbue their characters with what they're supposed to, as this opposite, a way to approach, you know, what faith is and spirituality and humanity.
I think that message is clear. So yeah. The story does a good job of showing the arc of like Robert De Niro's character and demonstrating Jeremy Irons' character's faith. It is effective. I just specifically, Robert De Niro seems so out of place. And then Liam Neeson, maybe because he's, you know, all these years later, like so recognizable to me.
Yeah, back then nobody would.
Right. So it's not fair to judge him based on that. But he didn't have much to do anyway. There was like very little emotion. I didn't feel any. Over 2 hours, the only time I felt anything was at the end when we see the kid get shot.
The end I thought was very emotional.
And then I got emotional. Like there's just no hope. And then we know how all these stories end.
Well,
because we can see the future, like that was very sad to me. But prior to that, it's like I didn't care about Jeremy Irons, like Robert De Niro, like none of them.
See, the moment with De Niro's breakdown, which that's a hard scene to pull off, the sobbing and then crying. But I think what I found moving about that scene is when Jeremy Irons goes to hug him. And Joffe, between this and Killing Fields, I think both films do a really good job of showing like a camaraderie or a deep friendship between men that a lot of films don't do or get in that way. Like there's an emotional component to this between like heterosexual men that I think Joffe for that time he did that part well.
Let's take a break and then I'll go through my notes. It's so weird seeing Liam Neeson younger,
yeah,
but he sounds exactly the same because he almost looks, I'm sure he looks younger than he actually was at that time.
Yes.
Because if you told me he was like 20, I'd believe it. He sounds exactly the same as he does in all these awful movies he does today.
It's just funny because him and Aidan Quinn were in that movie, that terrible movie reviewed, Blacklight.
Yes. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. When you hear the Jesuits say like, we're going to make Christians out of these people, it's just like, ugh, like I felt so duped. Like you really don't want to help these people.
They don't, really but don't. But then
think you're doing good, but you're not.
But Jeremy Irons, I think, is doing some. It's better than nothing because he offers them some protection. Because you know, like if we step out a little more, it's like, God, these white people, like these Europeans come here. This is, I've just lived here and we're going to take your land and we're going to sell you into slavery. And it's just, it's this ours to pillage. And it's just so shitty that,
you know what it makes me think of? All the times when I was in college where someone would approach me and be friendly with me and then invite me to like something.
Yes.
And then it was Amway. Uh-huh. Or recently someone I had hung out with who I had a bad experience with and you had to come help me. They reached out to me, like they actually called my phone, and they were super friendly and said they wanted to like have lunch. And I was like kind of shocked. And then come to find out they were trying to pitch me the company they work for. He saw what I do on LinkedIn and like was trying to pitch me something.
Which is very LA.
And I just thought, ugh, here we are.
Yep.
Aidan Quinn, who is handsome, I thought he reminded me of the drag queen Milk.
Okay. I mean, you seem to never remember who he is because we also just reviewed The Handmaid's Tale sometime this past year, which he's the male lead in. And of course, Legends of the Fall.
There's a scene where after De Niro gets like accepted by the Guarani people, I keep wanting to say Guarini like Justin. he goes hunting with them and they're like, they're about to kill an animal like a pig. And they tell him like, you do it. Like, you do it, Norbit. And he goes, no, and walks away.
Well, and you know what? That scene is also funny because there's almost an exact scene in The Deer Hunter from 78.
Well, but you know what? I thought my immediate thought when he didn't want to kill the pig was he better not eat that pig. And what's the next scene? Him with a big old plate of food.
Yeah, that's on purpose.
And then the other Jesuits are complaining that the food tastes bland because De Niro cooked it.
He doesn't know how to cook it.
Because he doesn't know how to cook.
No, he put all the chilies in it.
Yeah, so he didn't know how to season it properly, so he just threw a bunch of chili peppers in there.
And they're like, the bread's good. It's like, well, did he make the bread?
Well, and they go, the bread is okay.
Yeah.
Like, the best part is the bread.
The bread is bland bread. Okay.
Someone has a pet sloth. Who is that?
That is the Portuguese emissary, I believe. The sloth looks so cute.
A lot of y'all like to play with these animals because you think they look friendly or you think they're smiling. They're not smiling. That's how their face is shaped. Like
Same, sloth, girl. I'm sloths, not smiling at you.
Sloths are not like... Y'all need to leave these wild animals alone.
Oh, but he seems sweet. And then they talked about selling him on the streets of Portugal. And somebody's like... Does the sloth want to go to Portugal?
There is another scene where like the Spanish parliament people and the Jesuits and are all together. And Robert De Niro does speak up against the main guy saying like, y'all say you don't believe in slavery, but you allow it to happen.
So to me, the weakest part is Chuck Lowe, not because of his performance, who you should recognize as that man with the wigs and Goodfellas, but he's dubbed over very noticeably by Fred Melamed, who has a very distinct voice, and I hated how he sounded.
I don't know Frank Melamed, I didn't recognize the voice, so I didn't notice the bad dubbing.
If you look at Fred Melamed, like, you'll recognize that man.
And then he's, De Niro's forced to like give an apology, and he gives like old shady ass apology.
Yeah, he does.
So that was pretty good.
I like that he had a close bond with a little boy.
Yeah.
To
my final thought is like. Like, watching this movie made me feel like I feel about a lot of things. Like, all the dirty shit people have done in the name of Christ. Like,
yeah.
Like, Jesus would not condone any of what y'all are doing. These, you know, even how they call, like, the emissaries and how they have slaves and they're fanning that. Like, Jesus didn't even have
a fan. He didn't want that. He didn't.
How are you going to have a fancy dress and someone walking around with an umbrella over you?
We didn't.
And the person you worship wouldn't have even done that.
Right. Like, well, we didn't really talk about the cardinal who's there to make the decision about whether the Jesuits should retain their missions. Ray McAnally, playing Alta Murano, who kind of sort of narrates it. And there's one brief moment where the film dares to ponder through him. You know, I looked at all these Indians, he says, and I wondered if they wished that they'd never seen any one of us at all. And I wish that the film had taken a bit more of a harder stance on what exactly this missionary work has done to people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this would actually make a really good double feature with another film called The Mission, released from Nat Geo this year, which is focusing on that kid that decided to go to that island, like one of the last few tribes of people existing in the world that are, you know, untouched by Christ. He tried to go on his own to spread the word of Jeebus Crispy and got his ass killed. And that documentary talks to somebody that kind of did what the Jeremy Irons character did in this, and years later reflecting, being like, I spent all these years with these people. I don't think that they really became Christian, and I think I made a mistake.
Mm. What would you give The Mission?
Again, I don't think it's perfect, but I found it very moving, and it is a type of film that's not really made anymore. Even though we had something like Scorsese's Silence, which Liam Neeson also starred in, and of course a remake of a Japanese film, but I loved the look and the score, and I think the two lead performances are pretty good, even if you have to get past the disbelief of what their supposed ethnicities. I am giving it a 4 because
oh, wow.
By the end of it, I walked out of this in New York and walked a little 2 miles back to my hotel. And I don't know, I was kind of lost in the fog of it. I thought it does accomplish what it set out to do.
I thought it was okay. I would give it 2.5 out of 5. That was The Mission. I forgot to mention, I wanted to talk about, there's a website called Pest Gnome. It's like one of those aggregate sites that helps people find like exterminators. But they created a list using information from the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, and then like some other stuff, to come up with the most the list of the 25 most roach infested cities in the country.
Uh-huh.
California has 4 cities on there. Uh-huh. Number 23, San Francisco. Number 20, San Jose. Number 17, Riverside, California. And number 13, Los Angeles. The top 5, uh-huh. Number 5, Las Vegas.
Ooh.
Ooh. Number 4, Phoenix.
All these hot places.
Uh-huh.
All
right. Number 3, Tampa, Florida.
Yeah.
Number 2, San Antonio, Texas. And the number one most roach infested city in the United States is Houston, Texas.
Ooh.
Home of Beyonce.
isn't my friend Megan from there too?
So New York is number 11, so it's up there.
Isn't Megan Thee Stallion from there?
Megan's from Houston, but they're not dirty.
My friend.
And roaches are not. I don't think having roaches automatically means, because we had a house that we had an infestation. A pest problem, but it was because of the house wasn't infested.
The people next door were,
and the house had been fully redone, but was poorly redone.
Yeah,
so there were big gaps and things. So we spent a lot of time trying to like fix gaps, and once we did all that and sprayed, the problem decreased significantly. But yeah, so it's just embarrassing.
Have you watched the music video for Cobra?
Cobra,
the Megan Thee Stallion.
No.
Pretty good.
You're more up on her than I am.
Pretty good.
Oh, number 19, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, I never had that problem. I lived there, but you know, right. I read that the they've tried to really decrease the rodents problem in New York. And you know what? I think I only saw 3 on my walks.
Oh. Well, that's pretty good.
That's better than past some years.
Because I see more than that walking down downtown LA.
Oh, downtown LA is dirty.
I don't know what we're watching this week. I know our video for Napoleon drops tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll have a couple things.
And then
to get through. There's a new Isabel film that I have a screener for.
Okay. It
comes out in December. Anthony Hopkins playing Sigmund Freud. I think we got that.
Well, we should probably wrap up because we have things to do.
Yes.
Anything else?
No.
Ta-ta.